Your Health is supported by the North Carolina Cancer Hospital, serving you with innovative research and unequaled care. UNC Healthcare is leading, teaching, caring.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by 97.9 The Hill and UNC Family Medicine. Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our community. As Drs. Page and Goldstein specialize in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. And now, Your Health on 97.9 The Hill and on demand at chapelboro.com.
Welcome to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein, and I want to welcome our co-host today, Dr. Stephen Hooper. Welcome back, Stephen.
Thank you. Great to be here.
How's your day, week, month going?
Great. I do worry about the cold, windy, and gray days that may be coming.
Oh, you're just setting us up for a research that matters. We're also going to have a great guest today. We're talking to Dr. Patricia Johnson, a clinical audiologist and professor at the University of North Carolina, about healthy hearing, which I hope that we both have as we get older.
Agreed. And Dr. Johnson's one of our rock stars in audiology in my program. Great to have her.
Looking forward to that. Let's talk about cold, windy, gray days as the winter comes. Does that really matter, other than the fact I don't like cold weather?
Well, Adam, there's a study in JAMA Cardiology, so very good journal, noting that a temperature decrease from 68 degrees Fahrenheit to 30 degrees was associated with a 14% increase in heart attack risk.
Oh, that cold weather actually is bad for your health then.
So they say, but nobody would have thought it would actually have affected cardiac health.
Yeah, this was 274,000 heart attack patients.
274,000.
Yeah, 274,000. And they looked at different time points over almost 15 years. And it was conducted in Sweden, which I find kind of interesting. But it wasn't just the cold temperature change. It was also wind speed. If it went from 0 to 36 miles per hour, there was a 7% increase in risk. And it was also lack of sunshine. When it got cloudy and lack of sunshine, the risk went up by 11%. That sounds like Sweden in the winter.
But it's interesting. Those numbers are just astounding given something that's occurring every day in our ecology.
Yeah, you know, I know that there are some people who like to get out of the cold weather. They go down to Florida in the winter. And I've always kind of joked about it, but maybe they know something.
That's right. Arizona.
Yeah, we should all like kind of spend some time and kind of move on that. I'm not sure what one does with this research other than the fact maybe stay warm, understand that if one's exposed to cold, windy, dark days, particularly if you're outdoors, I don't know. I think there's more research here. It is a little worrisome.
The authors of this paper actually suggested that, well, flu might be associated with the heart attack because it's more common in the colder weather, and changes in physical activity and diet in colder weather may affect heart health as well. And they also raise the specter of depression in the colder, darker days. So there are other mechanisms here, but it is interesting.
You know, one of the things, though, that's interesting is that this did occur in Sweden, and the life expectancy in lots of places throughout Europe and Northern Europe is actually higher
or longer
than in many,
life, yeah,
many places in the world. And I think their life expectancy is almost 82 years of age, which is higher than here in the United States. So maybe we can find ways of improving the Swedish population and applying it elsewhere, but we got to improve everyone's longevity with lots of other things.
Agreed.
Let's talk about our next research that matter. And this is about breathing through the nose. Do you breathe through your nose?
I do.
Yeah, I do too. It's like how I kind of meditate. Breathe in through your nose, breathe out through your mouth. That's like the kind of big yoga thing. And, you know, we oftentimes teach people to take 5 deep breaths as a way of doing anxiety and stress, in through your nose, out through your mouth. I've never thought about it like, could it improve my memory?
Yes. There was a study in the Journal of Neuroscience, another study out of Sweden, where individuals who breathe through their noses as opposed to their mouths for an hour after a learning task actually had better memory for recall of those materials.
Yeah, they said it was of smells or things.
Of smells, yes.
Which I found kind of interesting. Like I thought, well, okay, well, sometimes, you know, if you take a deep breath, maybe the nose, and it triggers the smell receptors kind of that are at the back of the throat and so forth. But What I didn't really understand is this was not a test of kind of more global, more difficult, more complex memory issues. So I take it with a grain of salt.
We do know that there is a connection between those olfactory bulbs and the temporal regions where we have memory. So they don't talk about that connection in there as well. But the fact of the matter is that it's interesting in terms of, you know, just the memories that get generated when you smell something. Mm-hmm. And you wonder how it links back to this study.
Yeah, I think that I would love to see more research. So more to come. Let's talk about our next research that matters, which is a different type of smell. And this is really the flavor, which is frequently a function of smell. And flavors in e-cigarettes, electronic cigarettes, which is interesting because, of course, I do a lot of research on e-cigarettes and in flavors.
This is right up your alley.
Yeah, this was research actually out of colleagues both at Duke and at Yale and published in the journal Nicotine and Tobacco Research. And looking at what's happening in electronic cigarettes and the chemical changes that can cause inflammation in the user's airways as a result of likely the flavor exposure.
Yes, and I think the amazing thing about this whole area of scientific inquiry is while we're seeing nationally a trend for cigarette smoking to be dropping among teens, this product, this vaping product actually is going up. And in this study, note that it's 17% of high schoolers are actually doing this. So it's not a small number of adolescents that are being exposed.
Yes. The Food and Drug Administration is looking at this issue seriously about flavors in non-cigarette tobacco products. And I think they're increasingly going to and need to look at the flavors in electronic cigarettes. There seems to be an overwhelming amount of evidence that the flavors in the e-cigarettes actually are enticing to youth. It lowers their perception of the risk of the product. It increases their likelihood to experiment with the product, and it makes it less likely that they even quit. Adults, there's some question, could the flavors be important to quitting decisions? But if the chemical changes are occurring in the lungs, then the adverse health effects would be happening to not just to youth, but to the adults, which would then, I think, move the FDA to ultimately act to limit or ban the majority of flavors, which are over 7,000 flavors in electronic cigarettes.
Yeah, there's huge numbers. And the fact of the matter is it's not just damage, but you have a developing organism still on an adolescent. It's not just damage, but is it changing the developmental trajectory of the lung function over time?
Yeah, and that doesn't even include the exposure to nicotine, and which is inhibits the developing brain of adolescents. So lots of reasons to move and to act on a product that is essentially unregulated. Let's talk about our last research that matters. I didn't know a whole lot about it, and I have more questions than answers.
This is one that's a little bit frightening. It's polio-like paralysis cases that have been surfacing around the country, and I think we're well over 100 now.
Yeah, it's called flaccid myelitis, and it's basically more likely to be in children under the age of 19, and the biggest one is kids under the age of 4, and they really get almost like a paralysis, and it happens acutely, a muscle weakness, and then a limb, and obviously it can even cause death. So the scary part is we don't really know what's causing it. But I guess if you have a child that has any symptoms of this, you really need to get to your doctor immediately.
Yeah, and the symptoms can be apparently quite sudden, Adam. And when you see them, you don't wait and see. This is one that if you see symptoms, you go to your primary care provider pretty quickly.
Yeah, there's some belief that this is actually being caused by enterovirus is the type of virus that's similar to a poliovirus, but it's what causes the head colds and other sorts of symptoms. It's not due to the poliovirus. It's not due to a vaccine, because I'm sure there will be people that say, well, goodness gracious, so many kids get the poliovirus, so maybe that's what's causing it. Thus far, the CDC said they've done the research. It's not doing that. It appears to be a different type of virus unrelated to vaccination.
Yes. Last but not least, I think the authors of this research were saying that it is important to know that these are not that prevalent and common. They're coming up. We're hearing more about them, but they still remain rare. However, these things can happen quickly. Don't dismiss a common cold if you are the least bit worried.
Well, that'll conclude the Research That Matters portion of our show. We're going to take a short break, but when we return, we'll be talking with Dr. Patricia Johnson, clinical audiologist and professor at the University of North Carolina, about healthy hearing. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein, Dr. Steve Hooper. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
UNC Family Medicine's number 2 ranked national program is rapidly transforming healthcare through excellence in teaching, clinical care, and research. To participate in UNC Family Medicine's efforts to move innovative ideas into action, call 919-843-5112 or email yourhealth@unc.edu.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of 97.9 The Hill and UNC Family Medicine. And now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein, Dr. Steve Hooper. Today on Conversation, Steve, we're talking with Dr. Patricia Johnson, clinical audiologist and assistant professor with the UNC Speech and Hearing about healthy hearing. Welcome, Dr. Johnson.
Thank you so much for having me.
I'm excited to have Dr. Johnson because she is one of my faculty members. So thank you for being here.
You know, tell us a little bit about yourself. How did you decide to be an expert in audiology? What's the path? Did you wake up, when you were 4 years old and said, I want to be an audiologist?
No, in general, the population doesn't know what an audiologist is, so most of us fall into it accidentally. I wanted to be a music teacher, and when that didn't work out, what classes were open? Oh, Intro to Communication Disorders. And I just remember the first day I took that class learning about both how we learn to speak, how the hearing mechanism works, and I just thought it was so fascinating. Audiology is a great combination of counseling and medicine and technology all together.
Tell us a little bit about audiology. What is it?
Audiology is the diagnosis and treatment of both hearing and balance disorders. Sometimes we forget that the vestibular system is there attached to the hearing system as well. And so if anyone is having difficulty hearing or communicating, you would have your hearing tested by an audiologist, and then they would look at different treatment options, of which there are many. Immediately you might think of hearing aids, but also implantable devices and cochlear implants for those with profound loss.
Yeah, I'm thinking about a lot of my elderly patients and how many of them have falls. And one of the things I hadn't really thought about until you just mentioned this relationship between the hearing and the balance systems is, do people who have hearing loss, are they more likely to have falls? Is there concomitantly a decrease in balance? And do you see that? How does that come about?
Yeah, there absolutely is a correlation there. The same way that age-related hearing loss impacts those hair cells that sort of wear out over time, there's hair cells in the balance system as well that are also wearing out over time. And so absolutely, those with hearing loss are at a greater risk for falling.
And what sort of things do you do when a patient comes to you and you're taking a history and you hear there is a little bit of hearing loss and then you find out that they have been having some falls? We can understand perhaps is the hearing aid or, you know, is that that's not going to help the balance, is it?
Not necessarily, although I have heard of studies that have said that improving your hearing can improve your balance, partly because you have better spatial awareness. That's better awareness of what is happening around me. So I may be more or less likely to trip and fall on something if I just have a better sensory scape of what's around me. That also may give me better access to following health directives. So falling can be induced by a lot of other things as well, certain medications, if I'm dehydrated, other things, vision impairment as well.
You know, one of the things that we hear about is that folks don't want to get their hearing checked. What are some of the misconceptions or perhaps unfounded fears or maybe real fears that patients may have about audiology and getting their hearing checked?
Yeah, that's a great question. I do see those fears play out all the time. And people come in and they don't want to acknowledge that a part of their body is falling apart in some way that is inhibiting them. We have such a strong stigma to hearing loss and aging, and so I don't want to look old. I don't want my friends and family to treat me like I'm old. And then, of course, when it comes down to treatment, many people are just so worried of the sticker shock of what that treatment might cost, and that's a major barrier as well.
Yeah, I'm thinking about my mother, and when she came to visit us before she passed away 4 years later, we discovered that she really had some profound hearing loss. She was having the falls, as we mentioned before. And one of the things I hadn't appreciated clearly was how much the hearing in an elderly patient affected her quality of life. Mm-hmm. Tell me about your conversations maybe with the patient that you're thinking of and how that comes about. How do you ask about that and how do you start advising about that?
It makes me think of a patient who, he was introverted by nature, and sometimes they're more likely to write off their hearing loss because it's, well, I don't really need to be part of that conversation anyway. I'm okay just being present, being in the room. But reality, on the inside, they may be actually making an excuse for it. They would like to be part of the conversation, but it's too challenging. And so a lot of smiling and nodding, present but not participating. And for this one gentleman, once we treated his hearing loss, he realized just how much he was missing and how much he'd been using maybe some of his own personality traits as an excuse to not even try.
I remember with my mother that the audiologist had such great practical things, and I know we'll get in that in a minute, but it was also understanding that communication could also have visual. If she could see who she was talking with, that was better than not seeing. So being on the telephone was like the kiss of death, but being on an iPad with FaceTime, all of a sudden, the facial expressions. Do you teach people to kind of compensate?
Yeah, that's great. Visual cues help tremendously when we're trying to communicate. We all have a certain amount of natural lip-reading ability, and we get up to 30% of our word understanding is from just looking at people's faces. So if anyone's having difficulty hearing, face-to-face communication is one of the number one communication strategies that we recommend.
Nice. Tell me a little bit about the types of things when people come in and you do find hearing problems. You don't recommend hearing aids for everyone, clearly.
Mm-mm.
There's a whole range. What's down at the low end that you might say, maybe a patient who, you know, comes in and they've got, you know, like many of my patients, we all have about 20% kind of hearing loss, but probably don't need a hearing aid.
Yeah, for my borderline candidates or those who are having difficulty but don't really have hearing loss, which happens, it's called hidden hearing loss, starting with the communication strategies is first. What are some ways that we can just alter our behavior? We've mentioned facial cues. But there are plenty of over-the-counter amplifiers like TV ears. So maybe my main complaint is my spouse thinks the TV is too loud. There's some great wireless Bose headset that anyone can buy to better stream the sound into someone's ears. Or phones that have captioning. The state provides those at no charge if they're approved by an audiologist. So there are other types of assistive devices that are available that are not hearing aids. If your need is very isolated in setting, it's just one or two complaints. But there also are other types of over-the-counter amplifiers that are available and can be appropriate in certain cases.
Nice. And are they expensive?
In general, they are $30 to $200 a piece. I have seen ones in like the $1,000 range. They are not really personal amplifiers at that point, but they do tend to be pretty inexpensive.
Leads into another question related to this concept of hearing conservation. So how can our listeners protect their hearing, conserve what they have already if they've begun to experience loss? And you've mentioned some things already with the amplifiers, but what can we all do to sort of save our hearing and have hearing health, I guess?
Certainly protecting our ears in the presence of background noise comes to mind is a more obvious choice. If you're having to shout to someone arm's length away from you, it's too loud. You're possibly risking damage to your ears. And maybe one exposure like that will give you almost like a sunburn. You have a little bit of a threshold shift. Your hearing comes down a little bit, but it comes back. But if we keep exposing it like sunburn over and over again, you may have a more permanent
decline. Is this the concept we hear like going to rock concerts?
That's right.
Or being close to loud music?
That's right. I left the concert and maybe my ears felt a little fuzzy and maybe a little bit of ringing. That's the sunburn. So earplugs, of course, in loud environments. But also there's so much research now showing that anything that's good for our heart is also good for our ears. And that's exercising, that's eating well, making sure that our health is good. That's going to be good for your hearing as well. And we're not really focusing on that as much as we should.
Wow. Hadn't thought of that.
Last question before we take a break is when people are concerned that there may be some hearing loss, What are like the signs would be more likely that they're aware of it or that their spouse or sibling or child will say, Dad, you need to get your hearing checked?
It's a little bit of both. Your friends and family might be the ones to notice the loss first, but also people may notice, I'm fine and quiet. I'm fine if it's face-to-face, but as soon as I'm in background noise, that's where I begin to struggle. And that is really, really common for my patients, just because of how background noise starts to challenge what's called auditory processing, how my brain makes sense of the sound. Not just did I hear it, but how am I interpreting it? Listening fatigue can be an early sign. At the end of the day, man, I'm tired. I really had to focus so much harder. And it may be that your eyes and your brain are really trying to compensate for what you're not hearing, filling in the blanks.
Well, we're going to need to take a short break. But when we return, we'll continue talking with Dr. Patricia Johnson, clinical audiologist and assistant professor at the University of North Carolina, about healthy hearing. We'll be right back with your health. Stay with us.
Your Health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of 97.9 The Hill and UNC Family Medicine. And now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back. You're listening to Your Health. And we're talking with Dr. Patricia Johnson, clinical audiologist and assistant professor in the Department of Allied Health Sciences at the University of North Carolina, about healthy hearing. I'm curious, we've talked about hearing aids, and tell me a little bit about that. There's costs involved. Can I just go to Walmart and get them, or should I come to you first, or how does that process work if I decide I need a hearing aid?
It's a great question. So everything has to start with a really comprehensive hearing evaluation, one to determine whether or not the hearing loss could be treated either medically or surgically. So an audiologist would be able to take a thorough medical case history and refer you to the right specialist if that was needed. But for 90% of people with hearing loss, there is not a surgical or medical cure, and so we need to look at compensation or something like an amplifier or a hearing aid. These are ear-worn devices that take sound and amplify it, but not just all sound in a general way, in a very pitch-specific way. And it's the audiologist that actually programs and fine-tunes the computer chip of that hearing aid, and they are many computers at this point, to make sure that the device is safe and that it's effective.
In our first segment, we talked a little bit about, you know, the stigma of wearing a hearing aid and, you know, do our listeners, are they imagining a big visible thing on your ear or is
that it looks like a cancer?
Yeah,
well, the beige banana is what we used to call them, with these big chunky guys that went over the back of the ear. And that is what people have in mind sometimes when they come through.
And so what is it now?
So you know, once we've had the discussion, we'll start looking at different styles, and some of them are hardly bigger than a pencil eraser, and then others that fit over the ear are still very small. We're talking about peanut size. And once they're tucked behind the ear with a small wire that comes down the front, they're nearly invisible. They truly are. My patients walk in and I have to look and squint and go, are they wearing them? Oh, yep, nope, there they are.
A couple questions I have, and again, this comes from experience with family members a lot, that the two things that I was really struck by, one is how darn expensive they are. You know, you go in for a pair of glasses, and you might say, okay, I can get reading glasses, just like I can get the amplifier for my ears, but if I need prescription glasses, I go to see a doctor, or, you know, and I have to have a prescription, so I get a right fit, and I'm expecting those can be really expensive too, $200, but not $2,000 to $3,000. Why are hearing aids so expensive? And why doesn't Medicare and commercial insurance cover them? Crazy.
Yeah, we could spend a lot of time talking about this.
Go take the next hour. So, go right ahead.
The first answer is because it's out of pocket. So the hearing aids are expensive because it's a specialized health service that the patient themselves have to pay for every dime.
But why?
So Medicare.
Hearing is such a phenomenal thing to quality of life.
It's especially as folks get older.
Yes.
If they get older, it's. Yeah.
I know.
That's right.
Well, so when Medicare law was written, they statutorily excluded eyes, teeth, and ears, and particularly ears because hearing loss at that time was considered a normal part of aging, so why treat it? And the technology was not great at that time, so it was considered elective, and that's where it stayed. So even though the research has clearly shown that untreated hearing loss is associated with depression, lower quality of life, now cognitive decline, we're hoping that these types of studies are going to prove to lawmakers we need to be doing something about this because this is going to become a public health crisis. It already is in terms of the number of people who go untreated. We're only treating 25% of people who could benefit from hearing aids.
And if the price was lower, presumably that would improve it, correct?
Correct. Well, price lower and cover our services. Audiologists have been begging for our services to be covered for a long time, and the bills never make it through because Medicare hardly wants to add more cost to their services. But it's absolutely a need, no question.
Well, there's this new bill that was at Congress last year, the Over-the-Counter Hearing Aid Act, which I found really interesting because it seemed like it was designed to reduce the cost by making hearing aids available over the counter. Intuitively, first blush, seems like maybe there's some merit. What are some things that are either concerning about that, and is the intent right but the action wrong? How's that work?
Yeah, hearing aids live in a weird world in that they are viewed both as medical devices, which is how the FDA classifies them currently, and consumer electronics. And so when lawmakers have looked at how can we make hearing aids more affordable, their first thought was cut out the provider, give them the electronics directly. And that's what this bill has allowed the FDA to do, is to create a classification of over-the-counter amplifiers and hearing aids that can be purchased directly. But the caveat is that they're supposed to be only available for people with mild to moderate losses. And those are your borderline candidates, your people who are getting hearing aids maybe for the first time, just want something they're going to wear selectively. Now, how you control who's buying them on the shelves is a concern. Are they being evaluated in any way first to make sure it's not one of those medically treatable losses? Those are the major concerns.
Are there any, from the profession of audiology, are there any ethical issues with that process without having an audiologic exam or?
Several of the national professional groups of audiology have put out very strongly worded position statements of what they want the FDA to consider when they make this classification. And that, similar to like cigarettes, there should be some big warning on it that says you really should have your ears looked. What if it was just earwax? Something on there to at least warn the consumer before they buy the product. And I do want to make a point. These are not yet available. They will not be available until 2020. So the bill has passed giving the FDA the ability to start looking into this, but there's still a lot of input that has to go before they hit the market.
You know, it's funny you mentioned earwax, and I must see at least 5 to 7 cases a week of patients coming to see me and say the hearing's decreased my ear, and I know what it is before, you know, and go in and they've got this, you know, it looks like Hoover Dam. And,
or a raisin.
And how grateful they are when you just take a simple little bit of wax out of the ear and they hear a little bit better. Talk to me a little bit about, what's it feel like for you when you get the hearing corrected and people are able to hear better? Maybe there's a story that you have. I'm just kind of curious how, because it's got to feel great.
It does, because people have come to you with often very personal stories about how the hearing loss is, again, affecting their quality of life, is cutting them off from their friends and family. And so I can think of a gentleman who had been a musician for a long time and given up music because he couldn't hear well. And once we had fit him with some hearing aids, he cried. And I'm not saying I get tears all the time, but people certainly are very moved when they feel restored to the world.
Hmm. It seems simple, but there was a lot of steps involved to having that happen.
Certainly. I mean, you have to accept that you have the hearing loss first, at least be willing to get a baseline hearing test, go through the process of establishing the communication goals, finding the right treatment. But once the investment is there, I mean, our patients at the UNC Hearing and Communication Center are very happy and tell us every day how much it's improved their lives.
As we come to the end of this segment, Dr. Johnson, I just wanted to ask, as a follow-up to what you just said, How does somebody find an audiologist? How does somebody reach out for the listeners to get an audiologic exam, and does it hurt? I mean, those types of things.
Yeah, well, if you're having concerns about your hearing, you certainly do want to talk to your primary care physician. Medicare requires a referral from your physician. So even if you contact my office directly, you're going to need to go back to your physician to request the referral. But many times you can go to our professional organizations, audiology.org, find an audiologist there. You do have to be careful that you are, in fact, seeing a doctor of audiology, because hearing aids can also be sold by sales individuals, or are known as hearing aid dealers or hearing instrument specialists. And I always tell my students, anyone can buy a white coat. So make sure you are asking their credentials.
Give us just a 10, 20-second glimpse. What's on the future? What are we going to look forward to 10 years from now when you're back on the show? What's going to be the revelation and the innovation that's occurred?
Well, I'm really spend a lot of time in hearing technology world, and they're just going to get faster and smarter and more integrated. Already made for iPhone hearing aids are ubiquitous. That's not even a new thing anymore. So in terms of having devices that connect to other devices in our world and are tracking our every moment, for better or worse, I think that's definitely coming. But hopefully that leads also to better health outcomes.
Wonderful, wonderful. We want to thank you, Dr. Patricia Johnson, clinical audiologist and assistant professor with Allied Health at the University of North Carolina, being our guest today.
Thank you
so much.
Thank you.
It's a pleasure being here.
We're going to take a short break, but coming up on House Calls, we'll be answering questions about your health. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein, Dr. Steve Hooper. We'll be right back. Stay with us.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of 97.9 The Hill and UNC Family Medicine. And now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health for the House Call segment of our show today. Steve and I are going to spend a few minutes listening and talking about your health questions and concerns. Steve, if a listener has a question they'd like us to address on an upcoming show, they can send comments to yourhealth@unc.edu. And we'd like to ask our executive producer, Laura Lacey, to read us our very first House Call question. Laura?
My doctor has told us that my child has hypertension. I did not know kids could have that. What are some things that we should start thinking about to make sure we handle this appropriately?
Well, that's really an interesting and important question. And, you know, I'm trying to think of, in all the years on the show, if we've actually talked about pediatric or adolescent high blood pressure, but I'm beginning to see it more often. And it's an important question, because a lot of times we think, oh, well, they're kids, so they have a blood pressure of 120 over 80. But at a 7-year-old, that's actually high, not a normal blood pressure.
That's correct. And I think one of the things that has happened over the years is it's that assumption that blood pressure is not being checked and then scaled to the age and size of that youngster. And in fact, there are a number of children that are hypertensive as well as pre-hypertensive, of which they may benefit from various kinds of treatment.
You know, it's important to really take a comprehensive approach to this, because you need to understand whether or not this is kind of like the adult version of this, but in a child, which you don't find a cause, or if there's a secondary cause of this. They have some problem with their kidneys, they have some problem with their hormones, which is rare, but you know, you have to kind of think and look and some blood work to look at that. The things that I see most often is a child who's really obese. I see that quite a bit, and that isn't something that we can intervene on at that age before it even gets worse.
True. And I would say also that there are data that we've done in our research studies of pediatric hypertension and subthreshold pediatric hypertension, where we are finding cognitive issues related to attention and memory in children. They are not drastic. They are present and they are significant, and may be masquerading as attention deficit disorder. And so it's real important for these types of things to have a team approach to take a look at the various possibilities for why those issues may be there. And one of them could be hypertension or prehypertension.
Yeah, really.
And you treat them differently.
Really good advice. This is one of the things you do need to talk with your provider. You may need to see a specialist. Probably a team approach is going to be in order. Laura, what's our very next house call?
Last week, I had blood work done, and the doctor called back to tell me that my TSH was low. She recommended that I start medication. Is there anything I can do naturally to fix these levels? Should I get a second opinion? If I do need to start the medication, what side effects should I expect?
There's a number of questions in there, all of which are important.
Yes.
First off, let's unpack it a little bit. When our listener says that she got a call from her doctor and her TSH is low, I sometimes wonder, was this a telephone call and was it left on the answering machines? It sounds like if it was a different sort of call, some of these questions could have been answered and may not have come in the form of a question to us.
I hope it wasn't left on the phone message. We have some HIPAA issues as well that we probably
That's
don't
right.
want to get into.
But, you know, that let's face it, sometimes doctors are really busy a lot of times. And, you know, they may have just said, you know, I just want to call up Dr. Goldstein. You have that thyroid tissue. It's a little low. I think you need to be on medication. I'm going to call it. No, not okay. Not okay without a longer conversation. A TSH is low does not mean low thyroid. You have too little thyroid, as you would think. It's kind of the opposite. Complicated brain stuff we won't get into, but that would mean that you could be hyperthyroid, that you have too much thyroid, in case you should have some symptoms. Heart rate going up to kind of driven too much thyroid. You might feel hot all the time. Your hair might be falling out. Might be more jittery.
Your voice might be higher. Your hearing may be disrupted.
You could be talking real fast.
Yes.
And that's called thyroid storm. But your doctor probably either checked your thyroid because he was worried about that, or maybe that this is not really truly hyperthyroid. It's just a test result that's a little off, in which case you have to do more tests, like check a T4 and a T3, that thyroid hormones that actually really tell you. Because a lot of times the TSH can be off, but the T4 and T3 are normal, which means – okay, you got a little abnormality, but you're not hyper or hypothyroid. Don't need to do anything other than watch it.
Good advice.
Laura, what's our very last house call?
My 24-year-old daughter is seeing a therapist, but I'm not sure this person is the right fit for her. I don't see much improvement in her behavior or habits. Should I say something?
Well, there's a problem here, Mission Control, but it's unclear who has the problem, where the problem lies, and we can make some assumptions, but what are some initial thoughts, Steve?
Well, the first thing is you have a 24-year-old daughter, so the fact of the matter is that individual is an adult, and whatever is happening, whatever communication occurs, largely will be with your daughter and the therapist, and you will not be part of that process unless invited in.
Yeah, I couldn't agree with you more. And I think if you try to insert yourself, particularly if that daughter has a good relationship or thinks she has a good relationship with the therapist, even if you don't see the change, that's going to cause conflict between you and your daughter. Now, there may be conflict there already, and maybe that's what you're not seeing a change, but maybe she feels like changing. I think you need to open up some lines of conversation here between you and your daughter a little bit. Maybe you have a great relationship. Maybe she thinks that. Maybe she doesn't feel that she can advocate for herself, in which case maybe she'll want you to be in the room with the therapist to advocate. That's also a possibility. I've seen that too.
Absolutely. That collateral therapy, even from one session to another, can occur. The other thing I would put on the table just for some thought is the listener's definition of outcome success process may be very different than what they are working on in the therapy session. And to get to what the listener may be wanting may require a whole different process than what is occurring now. That doesn't necessarily mean a good thing or a bad thing, but there may be a mismatch in what people are expecting from that therapy session at that time frame.
Yeah, depression, severe depression, very difficult to treat, may need additional things like medication, may need to increase the dose of the medication, may need to increase the dose of the therapy. It may be seeing a psychologist, in which case maybe a psychiatrist needs to be involved. So lots of possibilities.
This is a tough one, and I think you always want to take care of your children even when they move into adulthood. And sometimes the best strategy is to be supportive, understanding, and be invited in when you are invited.
I think we'll end it on those good words. We want to thank all of you for joining us today for Your Health. We hope we've addressed issues that are important to you. You can share any questions by emailing us at yourhealth@unc.edu. You can visit us online at yourhealthradio.org or follow us on Twitter, Facebook, or iTunes. We'd like to thank the UNC Department of Family Medicine, UNC Healthcare for their sponsorship. Our co-host, Dr. Stephen Hooper, and our guest today, Dr. Patricia Johnson. We hope you join us next time on Your Health. On behalf of Your Health, I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
I'm Dr. Stephen Hooper.
We'll look forward to talking to you again next week. Take care.
The purpose of Your Health Radio is to educate listeners on healthcare issues. Listeners should always discuss their own health or medical concerns with their personal physician or other healthcare provider. Your Health is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
You've been listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on 97.9 The Hill, presented by UNC Family Medicine. You can find this or any other episode of Your Health on demand at chapelboro.com. Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on 97.9 The Hill, your community radio station.